Haman was stunned when he found himself in this terrible trap, to have the queen accuse him so dreadfully, to call him a devil, that is, a slanderer. In front of the king grew so angry that he rose from the table and went outside to take a walk in the garden. The king was terribly angry and distressed. Haman remained with the queen, and he realized that he was in a very unfavorable and unpleasant position. For this reason he begged the queen, for he saw that he was in the midst of evils. He went and pleaded with her. He fell to his knees to implore her in every way to help him, because he had fallen into this very difficult position. But what happened? In those days the seats were small couches, which for a moment could also be used as beds. For a moment they were little couches. So it seems that when the king rose from the table and went outside, the queen, in her turn, also rose from the table, and she must have gone to one such little couch, or to her bedroom. But when she went there to her bedroom, then Haman went right behind her, pleading with her continually. And for a moment Haman found himself sitting upon the bed of the queen. Of course, the situation was simply that he had gone to beg the queen to help him regain the king's favor. At that moment the king comes in and sees Haman sitting on the queen's bed, and he says, "So he even forces himself upon the woman in my own house. So what he has done is not enough. He has come into my wife's bedroom, into my house, to force my wife, that is, to behave shamefully, to violate my wife." Then the king's anger was terrible, and Haman, when he heard, his face fell. That is, when he heard this heavy charge, that he had gone to molest the queen, though of course he had not gone for that. Then, it says, he turned red, he was mortified, he did not know what to do. But notice, pay attention here. The matter is clearly set down by Holy Scripture that Haman had of course not gone to behave shamefully toward the queen. Certainly not, and all the more so at such a moment, it would be utterly unthinkable to seize such an opportunity. Such a moment to molest the queen. But what was at work here? That well-known proverb the people say, "Whoever wants to be rid of his dog puts it out as though it were rabid." Have you heard this proverb? That is, if you want to be done with a person, if you want him out of the way, you find a pretext, and you make a hare into a rope, a mountain out of a molehill. Precisely so as to find an argument and get him out of the way. What the king did was of course unjust, because if he had paid a little attention, if he had looked a little, and of course he did look, Haman was simply seated on the queen's bed, and she was perhaps sitting somewhere further off. Could such a thing ever have happened? And then it was not only the letter of the matter, it was also the spirit of the matter. Could it ever have been possible, as I told you, for such a thing to happen at that hour? But the king simply wanted a pretext. I would like, however, to stay on this point and say something to you. That it is a very bad thing to use an opportunity, a pretext, to strike at another person over other matters that are there. But have you noticed that people often do this? Often they seize on something, on nothing at all, in order to strike, because they have other scores to settle. But I tell you that this is not just, let us watch out for it, let us avoid it. Because more or less we have all perhaps done it, or we have become victims of such a situation. I personally have been the victim of such a situation once in my life, when people wanted to do me harm, and were always trying to find a pretext, some extraneous matter, something completely unrelated, in order to say many things. So be it. The point is that we should take care not to imitate this. But at the moment when the king said these words against Haman, a eunuch of the king intervenes, Bugathan, who adds to it. Indeed, he says to the king, "If only you knew what Haman has done. He has prepared a gallows 50 cubits high to hang Mordecai up on it." But why did Bugathan speak up at that very moment? Wasn't Haman the prime minister? Shouldn't a servant, have been careful with his words, in case he got himself into trouble with the prime minister? When the oak has fallen, every man gathers its wood. It is telling, my beloved, that when someone holds power, everyone treats him very well. The moment they see that this man is falling, everyone turns against him even before he has fallen yet. He is about to fall. Everyone turns against him, and they all begin to speak about the man who is doomed to die, whose star is about to set. How many times have we lived through this? So the conclusion that comes out of it is this: people are faithless. And when we hold an office and we see people surrounding us and praising us, saying and repeating words and courtesies and caresses and fawning and flattery, if I may put it the way the people do. Let us not put our trust in it. The moment you take a wrong step, these same people are ready to accuse you, and not only to accuse you, but with malicious joy to trample on you as well. This is a sad thing. Nevertheless, it is a trick of this world. That is, it is an element found within the doings of this world. When the king heard that Haman had prepared in the courtyard of his house a gallows 50 cubits high, about 25 meters, to hang Mordecai there. The same Mordecai, whom the king had especially honored that very morning. Then, in his anger and in his impulse, he said, "Let him be crucified upon it." That is, seize Haman and crucify this very man upon the gallows that he set up in his courtyard to hang Mordecai. It is terrible. One sees that when we dig a pit for another, we ourselves fall into it. What a great lesson, my dear ones. How many times have we seen this in our own life? To dig a pit for another and to fall into it yourself. And Haman was hanged upon the gallows that had been prepared for Mordecai. And Haman was hanged on that gallows which had been prepared for Mordecai. This detail, exactly as it is described here by the sacred writer, shows precisely what I told you. That you cannot set out to take revenge on another person, and unjustly at that, and dig a pit for them. Take care. For you yourself will be the one who is punished. And then the king's wrath died down. When Haman was actually hanged there on the wood, he was strung up on it. That same day, the king Xerxes tells Esther that he is granting her all of Haman's possessions. Everything Haman had, he gives to her. His house, his belongings, his money, everything. You remember that, when Haman wanted to exterminate the Jews, part of the whole plan was also the confiscation of their property, part of which would go into the royal coffers. And the rest, a very considerable sum, would go into Haman's own coffers. Do you remember that? Well, first of all, this was a principle of that era. And it was not only among the Persians, it was among all peoples, perhaps except the Greeks. The Greeks did not have this. That is, when a man fell into the king's disfavor, or was a condemned man due for hanging, his property was confiscated and went to the king or to the state. Even more so if that man's crime was high treason. We see this among the Romans too, later on. When they put the Christians to martyrdom and they died, their property was confiscated. Read the accounts of the martyrs, and you will see that the property of the Christians was confiscated for the emperor, for the state. Consequently, this should not surprise us, because whenever we read a text that belongs to a very old era, we must know the conditions under which everything was done, so that we do not misread it and misunderstand it. And then Esther tells the king that Mordecai is a relative of hers. For the first time she said this. Now there was no longer any reason to hide it. That Esther was a Judean, a Hebrew woman, and that Mordecai was a close relative of hers. Moreover, when the king saw, on the one hand, that Mordecai had saved his life by exposing that conspiracy against the king, and on the other hand, that he was a close relative of the queen, he set him in Haman's place. He made him prime minister. Something Mordecai would never have imagined. Here one truly sees how things are turned upside down. The one who does the wrong finds himself in Hades, and the one who is wronged finds himself lifted very high. All of this shows how God enters into history. It is just as I was telling you in Larissa on the subject of the Apocalypse, the book of Revelation, how we have exactly the testimony of God, how God, that is, reveals himself within history, how the unjust is punished and the just comes to light, even if for a moment it seems that injustice reigns and prevails. And then the king says to Esther, what else would he like to give her? And she fell at his feet and asked him to take away Haman's malice and all that he had done to the Jews. That is, to revoke Haman's decree, which had already gone out. It had reached the ends of the Persian Empire from India. We might say from the Indus River, all the way to Ethiopia in Africa, 127 satrapies. And now she begs the king to revoke the decree. And then the king looked with favor on this matter, and immediately gives an order that the queen, Esther, and Mordecai may consider it and draw up a new decree. And the king would simply sign it, write whatever you want, he says. And it will be sent. In good time, the second decree will be sent, which would revoke the first decree. What has very great beauty in it is the word that Esther says to the king. For how shall I be able to look upon the affliction of my people, and how shall I be able to be saved in the destruction of my homeland? I am a queen, I was saved. Mordecai too was saved. But my people, however, will be destroyed so long as this decree exists, which has already been unleashed. So how can I feel at peace when my people are wiped out? Notice, in the destruction of the homeland. Could Esther speak of her homeland? She could, and she did. This was possible because her homeland was under Persian occupation. And the Jews had been dragged into captivity, not by the Persians, but first by the Assyrians, and then by the Babylonians. And now they had come under the possession of the Persians, after Babylonia fell and was conquered by the Persians. But in any case, the people of Palestine were under the domination of the Persians. So the queen could indeed speak of her homeland. My dear ones, it does not matter if our homeland happens to be under an occupation. The point is that it remains our homeland. As, for example, with northern Epirus, they may say that it is not our homeland, but northern Epirus is our homeland. Our homeland is not Albania. Just as the Armenians can say the same, in the region of Turkey or of Russia, because Armenia is partly a piece of Turkey and partly a piece of Russia. What are the Armenians to say, who have a most powerful national consciousness? They speak of their homeland, of Armenia. A most ancient homeland, most ancient. So it makes no difference if our homeland lies under an occupation. And we must keep this sense alive. In the same way, Esther too keeps the sense of her homeland. And the king said to her, "Whatever you asked of me, I have given you. Tell me, what more do you seek? What else do you want? Write out this circular, this order, this decree, and I will set my seal to it. What else do you want?" And indeed, my dear friends, that is just what happened. A circular was written. A decree, translated into all the languages of the lands it was to reach. And it was sent out by couriers from India as far as Ethiopia, 127 countries, as I told you. The decree said many things. I will not read it all to you, because it is long. In any case, it states that many men, honored with many marks of distinction, thanks to the great kindness of their masters, like Haman, who was honored by the king, grew proud toward their benefactors. These men not only seek to do harm to our subjects, but, unable to carry the weight of these honors and distinctions, they weave intrigues against their masters, their benefactors, and so they are punished severely. For this reason, Haman, who had turned against the Hebrews, the subjects of my land, for this reason fell from favor and was punished. This is the spirit of the new decree that revokes the first one. Note that Herodotus tells us the Persians had a very strong sense of gratitude. They loathed the proud and the ungrateful man. They felt a bitterness whenever they saw ingratitude before them. So this ingratitude of Haman is especially stressed, along with his exploitation of the king's kindness, to forge this decree against the Jews. And the decree goes on to note, it continues, saying, "Therefore you will do well not to take into account the documents sent out by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, bearing in mind that Haman, the cause of all these evils, was hanged upon a gallows and crucified on it together with his whole household before the gates of Susa. God, the supreme Lord of all things, thus gave to him, without delay, the punishment he deserved. You shall post a copy of this letter in a public place, and you shall leave the Jews free to follow their own laws without hindrance." This, my dear friends, is what the decree said. But the decree says something else as well, since it was evidently drawn up by Esther and Mordecai. The decree, which I, the king, am sealing. And these things shall take place on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month called Adar. It was the date that had been fixed by the lot that fell to him. He found the date, Haman did, on which to kill all the Jews within a single day throughout the whole Persian realm. Because God, the Lord of all things, changed for his chosen people Israel the day of misfortune into a day of gladness. You, therefore, are to celebrate this great day with every kind of joy. This, you see, is what the king now writes, as one of your official feasts. This day is now and in the future, both for us and for all those who are favorably disposed toward the Persians, a feast of salvation, while for our enemies it is a reminder of their destruction. Note that this feast had a double character. It was the feast that the king had been saved from a conspiracy, in which Mordecai had played a part, as you remember, and secondly, that the Hebrews were saved. So this feast had a twofold character. It was a feast for the Persians, and it was a feast for the Jews as well. But at once, as I told you, Mordecai was proclaimed prime minister. And Mordecai went out arrayed in the royal robe, wearing a golden crown and a diadem of fine purple linen. And those who were in Susa rejoiced. When the Jews above all saw, of course, when they saw that Mordecai had risen to the highest offices, they rejoiced greatly. For the Jews there was light and gladness, that is, there was great joy that they had been delivered from the hands of Haman. Feasting and gladness, and many of the nations were circumcised and Judaized for fear of the Jews. Now pay attention here and see. It says the Hebrews were celebrating, and many of the idolaters, the Gentiles, Judaized and were even circumcised. Something the Hebrews did to themselves. Because they feared the Jews. For fear of the Jews. We meet this in the New Testament, for fear of the Jews, where the disciples were shut up inside the upper room. The evangelist John tells us this. Once Mordecai became prime minister, he was a Jew, and at once everyone was afraid. They were afraid and said, it would be just like him now, in his position, to unleash something against us. And it was unleashed, my beloved. You will see this later on. It was unleashed. And out of their fear, what did they do? They began to Judaize. That is, they took on Jewish behavior, saying, let us too worship the God that you worship. Let us live by the customs that you live by. All of this is shown, is called, by the name, to Judaize. To Judaize. This word, to Judaize, we will meet very often in the New Testament, in the epistles of the Apostle Paul. It was used when the Jews, in their turn, tried through the proselytizing they carried out among the Gentiles to make them Judaize. But the important thing is that the Hebrews, in their turn, the Jewish Christians, now tried to make the Gentile Christians, that is, the Christians who came from the nations, Judaize, and the Apostle Paul strikes this head on. So what were the Hebrews doing back then, in the time of the Apostle Paul? The Christian Hebrews, they would say, so you want to become a Christian, first you will become a Jew, a Hebrew, and then you will become a Christian. That is, you will undergo circumcision, you will keep all the ritual observances of the law, and only then will you become a Christian, be baptized, and so on. You understand, my dear ones, what this means, that we first had to become Jews, and only then become Christians. And the Apostle Paul truly struck this down mercilessly, and precisely because he struck it down, that is why he calls these people false brothers. These were the people who gave the Apostle Paul no peace at all. Wherever he went, they went right along behind him, and they caused him no small amount of hardship and no small amount of worry. Now that is an ugly thing in itself. But beyond that, there is also this. See how things repeat themselves within history. Remember that business with that eunuch who kept saying yes, yes, yes. Haman had even set up a pole to hang Mordecai on. Well, there are always the people of the situation of the moment, of whatever prevails right now. That is, those who try to grab hold of whatever holds sway today. How dreadful a thing this is. They have no political convictions, no religious convictions, and no moral convictions. Instead, they remain the people who always swim on the surface, whatever that surface may happen to be. Now, back then in Byzantium, or rather during Roman times, the church was persecuted without mercy. The Christians were persecuted relentlessly. And of course, if you were a Christian, you could not hold any political office and the like. It was impossible. You could hold no public office. When Constantine the Great suddenly proclaimed Christianity the official religion, how things changed. All the courtiers ran to be baptized. Why? Do you think? So as not to lose their positions. Because now the emperor had become a Christian. You see, these people did not really believe, but because the emperor is a Christian, because he had proclaimed Christianity the official religion, they rushed to fall in line so as not to lose their offices. For this very reason, in the time of Constantine the Great, a slackening of the Christians appeared, because so very many were baptized, they entered into the church uncatechized, and so from that time on, from then, from the beginning of the 4th century, right up to today, we suffer within the church from lax and frozen Christians. Back then, to become a Christian, you passed through many trials. Sometimes, you were a catechumen for whole years, and you had to give proof that you were a good and proper catechumen. Otherwise, you never became a Christian, they would not baptize you. And precisely for this reason, my dear ones, this astonishing thing was also noted. Those who were baptized were, the very next day, ready to become martyrs as well. And today we are Christians for whole years. Yet, when an occasion arises for us to bear witness, we are shamed into silence. That is the reason. But here is what happened. Esther was very much afraid that Haman, as the previous regime, had left many friends behind, and these people would surely have been displeased with this whole turn of events, and so they would remain forever dangerous to the Jews, and she asked that all those attached to Haman, all his friends, be put to death. The 10 children of Haman were also hanged on a post. This too was a custom of that era. When a person was executed, his whole family and all those close to him would be put to death, a custom of the time. And in a single day, in Susa, 500 people were killed, those who were openly hostile toward Mordecai and toward the Jews. Yet even so, the queen does not rest. These things, of course, we cannot easily grasp just as we read them here, unless we enter into the reality of the matter. For it seems she had information that conspiracies were afoot, and Esther does not rest, and she says to the king, I want you to grant one more day, so that one more cleansing may take place. And within the metropolis, that is, in the city, in the capital, in Susa, on the following day another 300 were killed, so in Susa altogether, 800 people were put to death, men capable of overthrowing the king, Esther, and Mordecai. But in the countryside as well, 15,000 men were killed. Throughout the whole royal domain, 15,000 were put to death, those who were named as enemies of the Jews. And then, you see, one may make a note here, an observation. This, that, my dear ones, say what you will. However great you may be, however holy you may be, when you hold an office, and especially a political office, you will find yourself compelled to act, even if you yourself did not rise out of any ambition. But solely in order to protect a people, you will certainly find yourself in the difficult position of signing death sentences. It is what the Apostle Paul says, that the ruler does not bear the sword in vain. That is, the one who governs does not carry the sword for nothing, but for the punishment of evil. And therefore, this cannot but happen. A society cannot stand if there is no punishment. And indeed, even execution, the death penalty. Look, please, at certain states, we do not yet have this. But it will come to us too, those that do not have the death penalty, that abolished it, see how crime has run wild. You will see how the criminal thinks, he says, that whatever I do, I will not lose my life. I will go to prison, something or other, a pardon here, a pardon there, and I will get out again. This, please, is how criminals think. And the trouble is that society has become filled with evil and crime, so what will a ruler do now? He will resort even to execution. And suppose this man is a cleric, what will he do? How will you sign? And how will you then go on to celebrate the liturgy? And when, even in this indirect way, you bear the stain of a murderer, you are not a killer, you are not a killer, you are not a criminal, yet you do sign a death sentence, an order of execution. Remember what God said to David, "You shall not build my temple, because you are a man of blood." My dear ones, the spiritual man, and much more the cleric, I do not know whether he ought to hold the highest offices. It is a true temptation for his very spiritual life. All those things that are said about a social Christianity, that we spiritual people should take hold of power, and so on, are a double-edged sword. Tell me, what true ascetic and saint would ever have consented to become a political ruler? Find me, in the whole history of our church, one who accepted this. It is another matter if he was a king and became a saint. And indeed we do have kings who are saints. We do. Who? What did they do toward the end of their life? No, not toward the end of their life. Sometimes much earlier. What of the general like Nikephoros Phokas, who wanted to go and become a monk? His friend Saint Athanasius the Athenite wrote to him, "Leave the affairs of the palace, leave the capital, and come here to become a monk." The poor man did not manage it. He did not manage it, because assassins came and murdered him in his own house. And do you know where they found him? Because he was an ascetic. He was an ascetic Nikephoros Phokas, the one who took Crete. What did Phokas do there? He did not sleep in his bed, for reasons of ascetic discipline. And when the assassins came in, they did not find him in his bed. They looked under the bed. And as they bent down and saw him under the bed, they killed him. He did not manage to escape. So I want to tell you that very many kings and rulers left their kingdoms and their offices and became monks, and queens too. Do we not have holy kings and queens? But furthermore, if you like, the one who served as a ruler and signed a death sentence cannot become a priest. He cannot become a priest. That is why you understand, my dear ones, that offices are always a temptation for the spiritual life. I say it, and for what reason do I say it? So that we may understand that Christianity is not a social or worldly affair. It is the calling of God to his own kingdom, that here we have no homeland. And let us not busy ourselves overmuch with the present world. That is why I told you this. Of course, things in the Old Testament are different. Let us not forget at any moment that we are standing on Old Testament ground. In any case, it is characteristic that when the Jews killed all these people, they did not plunder their possessions. And they plundered nothing. I tell you only that, in a passage above, if you read the relevant text, it says they plundered. Further down, it says twice, they did not plunder. This is a copyist error. The Hebrew text there, too, says neither did they plunder, to show that the cause of this attack was not that they desired the possessions of others, but that they were seeking their own personal safety from their enemies. In any case, this clearing out lasted one day in the countryside, 2 days in Susa. For this reason, that is, it was the 13th of the month of Adar, which corresponds roughly to our January. On the 13th of the month it happened in Susa. Then the second day, the 14th of the month, and the third day, the 15th of the month. There was a festival, a celebration, by the Jews, because they had been delivered from this national catastrophe. This feast they named Furor, or Purim, take note. Furor, as it is written here in Holy Scripture, and it stays within quotation marks. It gives the impression that it is a Greek word like frura, a guard. Indeed, with the very same spelling, frur is not a Greek word. But it is Persian, and it translates the word lot, which in Hebrew is Purim, because Haman cast lots to decide when to carry out this slaughter against the Jews. That is why this feast was named Lots, Purim. I will come back to the subject of the feast. The point is that Mordecai now put out a book, that is, a written account. And there he writes the whole story. How Haman was hanged, and how Mordecai rose to the highest offices within the Persian kingdom. He records it all, and he says that everything that happened, happened because God wanted to deliver us from this disaster. And after he lays out the history of the events, he gives this command, that on these 2 days, the 14th and 15th of the month of Adar, you shall keep a feast, and you shall rejoice. But first, on the 13th of the month, you shall fast. One day of fasting, on the 13th of the month, in remembrance of the fast of Esther and of Mordecai. And on the 14th and 15th of the month, which were the days set in the decree for the Jews to be killed, you shall keep a feast, and in the midst of your great joy, sending portions to your friends and to the poor, you shall exchange food and gifts among yourselves, and likewise, you shall give food and gifts to the poor. Does this remind you of anything, please? Sending portions to friends and to the poor? Does it remind you of something? It was the custom among the Jews. We Greeks have it too. I remember, as a child, we used to do this very often. You would go to your neighbor, when of course you were on good terms with her, not hostile. Did you make grape must custard? You bring her some grape must custard. Did she make a honey cake? She brings you a honey cake. So an exchange of these good things takes place from one house to the other, and so on. It is very lovely. It is truly lovely when we have some product, some of our own goods, and we make a little distribution of it, like a blessing. Many people have fresh grape must this season, and they give grape must to that other house so they can make a little of the flour dish. It is lovely, it is truly lovely. I do not know whether we, as ancient Greeks, had this custom, but it is found among the Jews. We find it, my dear ones, in the book of the Apocalypse, when they will hang the two prophets in Jerusalem, who will be the prophet Elijah and Enoch. They will point out the Antichrist and will preach metanoia, repentance, and the Antichrist and his people will hang them. in the square of Jerusalem, and this is with all precision. There is no allegory here, nothing of the kind. It is not an allegorical image. It is history told beforehand. Then everyone will rejoice at their death and will exchange gifts. So the exchanging of gifts is an expression of joy. And that is how the Jews were meant to celebrate this feast, with great joy, nothing else. Elsewhere it says, as Mordecai writes in his book, that this is to be kept as a memorial from generation to generation in every city and family and land. You shall keep this feast every year, from generation to generation, from tribe to tribe, and from country to country, wherever you may be. You shall keep this feast as a memorial. A memorial of what? That God rewards what is good, and he punishes injustice. That is what it will be, my dear ones. The lesson of the whole book becomes this, that God rewards the good and punishes injustice. It is never possible for injustice to prevail for long. Is this not a wonderful foreshadowing of what will happen on the last day, when the sinners who took delight in their injustices will be led into eternal hell, and the righteous who suffer and are trampled down will be led into the kingdom of God? We might say that Esther, with the feast, the book of Esther, with the feast of Purim, is a prelude to the last things. Of course, here we have a historical event with a historical echo. And yet, so many things stand as prophecies, so many feasts within the Old Testament. What else do they echo but the last things? But the end, and what astonishes us is this, that this feast of Purim, my dear ones, is celebrated to this very day. Can you imagine it, that this feast is still celebrated to this very day, here? I have with me a Jewish periodical, the Chronicles, Chronica, published in Athens. It belongs to the Jewish community in Athens, for all the Jews of Greece. Purim, the Feast of Purim, right up to today. Does it strike you? It strikes you. It strikes me very deeply, and that is why I brought it for you to see. And what do they celebrate? I read the article. There is no time left, but I will read it to you now, of course. What does this article want to stress? I underline something here. The lesson of this feast, the periodical says, is that evil is punished, while on the contrary justice in the end prevails and conquers. The rabbis. So the rabbis say in the Talmud, want to proclaim that even when the Messiah comes, O poor ones, the Messiah has not come for you when the Mashiach comes, when all the other feasts will cease to be celebrated, Purim will still continue to be kept, and another rabbinic saying again proclaims, when the month of Adar begins, joy is multiplied, which for the Jews means what? Indeed, here there are also two paintings. One is by Oppenheim, Purim at home, and the other is by the well-known Rembrandt, the Dutch painter, where Haman leads Mordecai in procession through the city, of which it is said, thus does the king honor those whom he wishes to honor. There are two paintings, so what do we want to say with all of this here? According to one version, forgive me, the name Purim comes from the word pur, which means lot, and it refers to the schemes of Haman, who cast a lot to decide which day he would set for the extermination of the Jews. But the same thing is stated here as well. It is stated here too. Within the text itself, it explains the word Purim, fur. It explains it. Pay attention. Where lies the value of the matter? The value is in this. A people that remembers the national days of its salvation, that people never dies. It never dies. It always preserves its national consciousness. That is, we Greeks, I mean, if we remember a March 25th, 1821, and I will not go to other feasts, I will not go to October 28th. No, I go to March 25th, 1821. If we remember this day as a nation, we will never die. Why? Because it is the starting point of our existence, the historical memory. The feasts we keep are not for spending some money, some army tanks, having schools parade, and so on. That is, for the sake of appearances, or even, if you like, for political reasons, to display before the eyes of those who are watching, to show that we have new weapons, that we stand in military preparation and readiness. No, no. All of this is secondary. Historical memory is the great issue. And I have told you before, the enemies of our homeland want to erase the feasts from the memory of the Greeks, just as they want to erase the Christian feasts. Does not a verse in the Psalms say, come, let us remove the feasts of God from the land? Once we remove the feasts, say the enemies of God, the memory of God will be forgotten, Come, let us remove the feasts of the saints, and the saints will be forgotten. Come, let us remove the national feasts, and our history will be forgotten. So know this, when these feasts fade away, the people is condemned, whether as a faith or as a people that has a homeland, it is condemned to death. So it is no small thing that we should always keep a feast. You saw how the Jews remember and what they remember. And you saw how they say that when the Messiah comes, all the feast may pass away, but not Purim. Why? Is not Passover a great feast for you? Is not Pentecost a great feast? Why is it so? Because the Jews of today have thrown the whole weight of the awaited Messiah onto a national triumph, and a worldwide triumph, an earthly one. An earthly triumph, these are the mistaken notions they hold about the Messiah. Well then, that is why they say that Purim will live on. Purim will live on. They are worthy to survive. If you like, if they think this way, we Greeks are unworthy to survive, because we sit and listen to the voice of our enemies. My beloved, we will always keep the feasts. And if you like, I say this in support of the whole subject. Do you know why we are going to hold, God willing, a vigil on the 28th of October, precisely to underline this historical memory? That is to say what? It is not that there is a three-day holiday, and I would take the chance to tell you, come, because the next day you will not have to go to work and you will be tired. So go and sleep. The point is to underline our gratitude to God, who has kept us free until now. Rightly do they hold a vigil in Thessaloniki as well, for the same reason rightly. And indeed it should perhaps be done in all the churches, or at least in every city in at least one church. In Larissa, at the Metropolitan Cathedral, there will be a vigil to underline this historical memory, and also our gratitude to God, who has saved us. So it is. These things have very great value, my beloved, and very great importance. This is how this book closes. The book of Esther closes, underlining these chief characteristics. So let us too hold on to all of this, always. And if God should ever permit some national ordeal of ours, and God has permitted many times such national ordeals, short or long, from the 400 years under the Turks to the 4 years under the Germans and the Italians, whatever God ever permits for our chastisement, when God then delivers us afterward, let us always remember the benefactions of God. That is what it means to be a people, to be a nation. Do you not want us to survive as a people? Say what it is you do not want. Do you not want us to keep our language? Do you not want us to keep our national consciousness, our faith? Do you not want it? Do you want us to be Europeanized? To write with Latin letters? Is this what you want? Is this what we should think of doing? Know it well. To write with Latin letters, and to abolish the Greek alphabet, and other things. Little by little, we would no longer even speak Greek. Do you want that? So then, if we want to live, I will say it one more time. And then I close. Let us always remember these great days of the benefactions of God. And let us celebrate them. Let us celebrate them with the divine liturgy, with doxology, with a vigil, with a holiday, and if you like, with a well-laid table, too. Let us rejoice on those days when God granted us his benefaction so that we might be free. My beloved, here I close, and may God bless you. Now, starting this coming Wednesday, we turn to another book of Holy Scripture. We will see whatever God gives us to see.